Now on RTE Radio 1, stories making headlines around the world on World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, how a teenage girl from Cameroon is changing perceptions about young women in the sport of football, and we hear about people trafficking in the Las Vegas of Bulgaria. But first we go to Denmark, and this week the world's eyes suddenly turn to the sea just off the Danish coast and to the massive gas leaks from the Nord Stream pipelines in the Baltic Sea. Much points to the rupturing of the pipeline being a deliberate act of sabotage linked to the war in Ukraine. From Denmark, Tom Carstensen reports.
In Denmark and most European countries, gas prices have soared in the recent months, a couple of years in fact, but recently sped up by the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. My own personal gas bills have tripled in the last 2 years. This has consequences. Many people simply are afraid of turning on the heating. In Denmark, stories of people having to sell their homes due to the exploding gas and electric prices have been more and more frequent in recent months, well before the leaks. A Danish manufacturer of woolen slippers last week said they have more than tripled their sales due to people not turning on the heat. On Tuesday, those prices soared even more. This was after a number of leaks in the two major gas pipelines, Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2, were discovered about 20 kilometers south of the Danish island of Bornholm. Bornholm is a small island southeast of Denmark. It is in fact closer to both Sweden and Poland than it is to the rest of Denmark to which it belongs. It's situated in a very important strategic place in the middle of the Baltic Sea. When the rest of Denmark was liberated by the Allied forces, mainly British soldiers, at the end of World War II, Bornholm was liberated by Russian forces. And while the Western Allied forces left the Danes to it quite quickly, the communist Russian forces stayed and occupied Bornholm for about a year after the war. Many allegations of rape and other atrocities committed by the Russian forces have been heard since. It became very clear that this island was, and in fact in the future, would be a very strategic geopolitical interest. That has also led to the conclusion that it's no coincidence that the leak happened just outside the official Danish waters, but in international waters, but only by a few miles. Had the leaks happened within the Danish waters, it would easily have been considered as an attack on Denmark, and therefore NATO. The argument that it did not happen in Danish waters and is therefore not an act of war against the sovereign state of Denmark and NATO has been stressed by both the Danish Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, clearly to try to tone things down. They have also both said that there is no doubt that the leaks were caused by a deliberate act and not by accident. During the past week, it has emerged that there are 4 leaks in the pipelines. But who did it and how? We may never know, says Danish military and intelligence experts, but it's clear that you'd need some sort of submarine technology to do what has happened. It could be done with an either specialized submarine or with underwater drones controlled from above the water. Seismologists have declared that there has been measurable incidents, i.e. explosions, and that they had the same strength of large bombs used in the Second World War by the time of the leaks. Many quickly pointed to Russia due to the ongoing war in the Ukraine. And the fact that it happened at the same time the Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen was in Poland to officially open the new non-Russian-controlled Baltic pipeline has been used as an argument for this. Basically, that Putin was sending a message. But again, the Danish and the Swedish authorities have been very reluctant to make any statements pointing fingers directly towards Russia and Putin. Russia itself has called it an act of international terrorism and wants a full investigation. Some voices, some would call them conspiracy theorists, have pointed to a 7-month-old clip of the US President Joe Biden saying something along the lines of that the US, in case of a Russian invasion of the Ukraine, would look at shutting down Nord Stream 1 and 2. The notion is that it's because they are controlled by Russia and therefore a means of income from transporting Russian gas to Europe. The US have denied the allegations. Will we ever find out who is behind? According to Danish experts, it's by no means likely. One thing we do know is that the leaks are going to take some time fixing. And at the same time, gas prices are still going up, putting pressure on citizens depending on this source of energy to heat their homes and water. In Denmark, more than 400,000 households are dependent on natural gas for this. This is in a country of only 6 million people. The Danish government has stressed that the leaks do not pose a threat to delivering gas to its citizens, but still it's a pressure point. And this is also because a lot of the Danish gas from the North Sea is not accessible until 2023, because some of the major gas platforms getting it out of the ocean there are away from maintenance and won't be back until next year. So regardless of who did what and why, it seems the Danes are staring into another cold winter and may have to stock up on those woolen slippers. For World Report, this is Tom Carstensen in Copenhagen.
Next we go to Cameroon and the story of a teenage girl from the indigenous Mbororo community in the Adamawa region of Cameroon with a passion and talent for football. Habiba Osmanu is attempting to defy traditional beliefs to become a professional footballer in the future. But she faces many obstacles, living in a society where many people don't believe that females should play football. From Cameroon, Dorcas Akupe reports.
The football talent of young Habiba Osmanu came to the light after a video was posted on social media showing her juggling a ball with incredible ease and skill. The person who shot the video that went viral made his feelings known. He wondered how a 15-year-old girl could have such amazing soccer skills. A few days later, after the video was posted online, Habiba was invited to Sungaonvere, chief town of the Adamawa region of Cameroon, located over 190 kilometers from her native Johong village, to participate in a female football tournament. According to Muhammadu Lamino, a former player of a professional football club and the brain behind the tournament, the video of the girl juggling the ball caught his attention, and he needed to see her in action on the pitch, so invited her to play with other girls in the main town of the Sahelian region. In an area where girls have limited access to activities like football, Habiba's performance and determination during the game convinced the football professionals present, including Cameroon's Indomitable Lionesses head coach Gabriel Zabo, that this girl was a special talent. Zabo says he is convinced Habiba's talent can develop more and is sure that with hard work she will be able to replace female football stars like Shoot Ajara Njoya and Abudi Ongena in the national team in the future. The coach expressed the need for the girl to be given more opportunities to showcase her talent, which can be a guarantee of a greater fortune in the sport. On the pitch, she plays as an attacking midfielder, a position she says permits her to greatly assist teammates and provide several scoring opportunities. While talking to War Report, Habiba explains that she is the fourth child out of a family of seven. She admits her parents have never accepted or loved the fact that she plays football. The teenager says that from the age of six, she started playing with other boys in her neighborhood, and this often resulted in arguments with her father. With a smile on her face, she tells this reporter that she was determined to keep playing despite her father's disapproval. Habiba adds that each time she is juggling the ball and she sees her father coming, she hides the ball and pretends to be busy with some kitchen stuff. Her father doesn't want her to play with boys. He says it's a taboo for a girl to play football with boys. Her native area, Johong, and the Adamawa region of the Central African nation, a stronghold of traditional and cultural beliefs that the woman must not be exposed to certain practices, was still football. As a lady from the indigenous Mbororo community, something Habiba needs to focus solely on her education and household chores. However, the young footballer is changing narratives, writing her own story, and creating new perspectives for the female folk in the region. Unlike her father Osmanu Yaya and mother Salamatu, the aspiring footballer is actively supported in her endeavor by her eldest brother Osman. According to Osman, it gives him great joy each time he accompanies and even watches his kid sister display her skills on the pitch. He declares that he is engaging in serious talks to convince his parents to accept the decision of their daughter to pursue her dream of becoming a footballer. Another young lady, Bilkis, who highlights the fact that Habiba's determination in playing football has inspired her to want to play and join the game. She admits that though she is still unable to play as well as Habiba, she continues working hard to be at the same level someday. More girls in Cameroon are becoming more interested in football as the sector has gained considerable development and improvement over the past years. Cameroon's national female football team have had incredible success in recent years and serves as an inspiration to girls like Habiba. Despite her parents' lack of enthusiasm for her chosen sport, Habiba is gaining growing support and is determined to achieve her dream of becoming a professional football player someday. For World Report, this is Dorcas Ekupe reporting from the Damara region of Cameroon.
Finally, we go to Bulgaria and the Balkan town of Svilengrad, which made its name for trading silk. Now it's better known as the Las Vegas of Bulgaria. 24-hour casinos are a big draw for locals, as well as enticing Turks and Greeks across the border. But as Frank Scholdeis discovered, gambling is not the only cross-border business to spring up on the old Silk Road.
If Las Vegas was in Bulgaria, it would be here in Svilengrad. The town has gone through so many changes that even its name, which means Silk Town, is outdated. Silk production ceased in these parts long ago. Instead, the riverside town of about 20,000 people now feeds off a different sort of business. Neon-lit casinos with glamorous names, Imperial Palace, Nymph Princess, Monaco Complex, a 24/7 seduction to while away the hours in the company of a one-armed bandit. Svilengrad's unique location is ready-made for international clientele. A couple of miles east lies Greece. During the Cold War, this was a tense interface between East and West. Now, I see Bulgarian police escort a NATO military convoy across the border. It's like watching history turned on its head. Head north a few miles and you're in Turkey. The crossing at Kapitan Andreevo is one of the busiest in the EU. 11 lanes of traffic crawling through customs while thousands of articulated trucks literally bake in the dusty heat of the Thracian plain. Silk Town came to prominence 5 centuries ago as the main route between Vienna and Istanbul, which is why Suleiman the Magnificent commissioned Mustafa Pasha to build an Ottoman-style bridge across the Maritsa River. Pasha did such a fine job with an awe-inspiring 20-arch stone bridge that the Sultan asked that it be named after him. But rather than surrender credit for the greatest achievement of his life, Pasha chose instead to take poison, a drastic act that didn't go down too well with the Sultan either. Standing here 500 years later, it remains a majestic construction, comparable to the Visegrad crossing in Bosnia, which inspired Ivo Andrić's Balkan classic, The Bridge on the Drina. Silk Town was burnt to the ground during the Balkan Wars 109 years ago, after which ethnic Greeks returned to Greece, ethnic Turks left for Turkey, and ethnic Bulgarians came back home. Then it all happened again in 1989 when Bulgaria deported over 300,000 ethnic Turks. At a time of huge change in Europe, this mass purge was underreported, but then again, geopolitics in this region usually means upheaval. As the curator at a local museum remarked, Svilengrad has always been a thoroughfare for refugees. In fact, the trade in silk has been replaced by a more lucrative trade in people. A path through Greece, Bulgaria, Kosovo, North Macedonia and Serbia is the main route for illegal immigration into the EU. Trafficked in overcrowded dinghies or in the back of trucks or by foot across mountains. Whether fleeing conflict in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan or pursuing economic opportunity out of Morocco or Pakistan, they arrive in numbers every day. Refugee camps funded by the EU have mushroomed in towns along Bulgaria's southeast corridor. I find a patrol car parked in the shade on the now disused old road into Turkey. Border security. An older Bulgarian policeman and a younger German officer from Berlin dispatched to oversee the EU's eastern frontier. The border used to be a job for the army, grumbled the older man. Now it's a job for the police. He had grown up under a communist regime in the Soviet bloc, but here he was now working alongside a young colleague from reunified Germany. Maybe it was the extreme September heat, but he just seemed weary. "The world has changed," he said with a sigh and resumed watching the empty road. Silk Town was calling. Only a matter of time before a gaggle of exhausted men and women would appear on the horizon, carrying all worldly possessions on their backs. One last roll of the dice in the hope of changing fortunes, crossing the fence to finally land on this dusty stretch of Europe. In the distance, they would see its neon promise tell of riches to be won and the life-changing possibilities of jackpots. But the casinos might feel like a mirage, a casual flutter in games of chance, irrelevant when you've already gambled everything you've got, a high-risk bet on all or nothing. For World Report, this is Frank Scholdeis in Svilengrad, southern Bulgaria.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.